the genesis of me realizing how critical transparency was, I've always felt like it's an important characteristic just in your personal characters that you're transparent. I did a kind of barnstorming tour where I did a one-on-one via Zoom with every single person on our team. And I had an entire questionnaire that I went through asking them about the company, asking them about leadership, how they experienced different things. And I think 70% of people voluntarily chose the word transparency. And I realized, wow, this is a huge deal to the team, but also it seems like we've really been able to achieve that kind of a culture.
Welcome to the Let's Talk Business podcast. Gain valuable and actionable tools from the world's top business leaders to help you grow, lead, and succeed. Here's your host, Manny Hoffman.
Coming to you from the PTX headquarters in Brooklyn, New York, this is the podcast for no-nonsense advice to help you learn, grow, and lead. Today, I'm so excited to welcome our guest, Mike Beckham. Mike is the co-founder and CEO of Simple Modern, one of the world's largest and most successful drinkware companies. Mike also helps found several e-commerce businesses, which have together generated over $1 billion in revenue, and has been involved both in the for-profit and non-profit sectors. While he runs his company, he also found time to teach entrepreneurship at the University of Oklahoma. Now, everybody knows that company culture is important, but that's a lot of different from actually building a culture that sticks, makes your business better, and gives your employee a sense of mission. How can you build a meaningful and deep-rooted company culture that will also make your business stronger and more successful? That and so much more is in our interview. Mike, thank you so much for joining me on the Let's Talk Business podcast.
Thanks for having me, Manny. It's good to be with you.
Absolutely. So I followed your brand on Amazon, off Amazon. I followed the content that you share for a long time, and I'm so happy we're able to connect and speak today. Because if you want to, speak about your brand from a branding perspective, on the product category, on the Amazon side, and company and culture and leadership, there's so much to talk. So thank you so much for making the time. I know you're a busy person.
Happy to be with you, and I really enjoy talking about these things. I know that the people listening to this show are entrepreneurs, and I love being able to share any insights that I've learned, often by doing things the wrong way, if it can help others be successful in their business.
Sure. So let's start a little bit of a backstory. So obviously, you're co-founder and CEO of Simple Modern, a company that has been doing, very good I'm not sure if you want to share some revenue numbers, but I think you've been very successful in building your own brand. Recently, I've seen that you started manufacturing locally in the US. So there's a lot to talk there. Tell us a little bit of the backstory, where you started.
Yeah. So my backstory is pretty atypical. I was a finance major in college. And then through a series of events, the job I took out of college was with a nonprofit ministry. And I actually worked in the nonprofit world for my entire 20s. So not exactly the ideal way to learn about e-commerce or starting a business, or at least you wouldn't draw it up that way, but incredibly life-shaping. And I think that one of the ways that plays out today is that because of my time in the nonprofit world, I learned to lead through influence as opposed to position. And I learned how to build a compelling vision for people to be a part of that they want to join. Around my 30th birthday, I was leading in this nonprofit context. My younger brother wanted to start a company. He'd been pretty successful in affiliate marketing. And I thought this will be a really fun side project, and helped him recruit some other kind of people to start the company with. And we launched it in October 2009. And that company ended up being much more successful since then. So about the last, my career is about 20 years long, and about half and half, half of it in the nonprofit world, half of it in the for-profit world. And ironically, that my time in the nonprofit world, I think, helped prepare me to be a much better leader in the for-profit world. In 2015, after working with my brother for several years, a couple of coworkers of mine that I had pretty deep friendships with, had known for quite a while, approached me and said, "Hey, would you be willing to start a side project with us? Because we really just enjoyed working with each other. We knew we wanted to sell online. We wanted to start on the Amazon marketplace. We wanted to sell a really high quality product. We wanted to create a culture that was based on generosity. That was it. Didn't know what product we wanted to sell. Didn't know anything else. And that little side project is what's grown into Simple Modern today. So you alluded to it, but at this point we're at fairly significant scale. We've been incredibly fortunate with the way things have gone. I mean, I think it's been the combination of having a really high quality team, seeing an opportunity in the market and really taking advantage of it while that window is open. And then probably some good fortune as well. But at this point, we're a 9-figure revenue company. We are sold in Target, Walmart, you know, Amazon. We're the number one supplier in our category by units. You know, Sam's Club, we've gotten to some pretty significant scale. We're licensed with a lot of pretty much everybody in the licensing world. And so it's been a lot of fun for me because I had not really built a consumer brand before this. And so not only is it gratifying to see something that you've helped to create become meaningful to other people, but it's also been a lot of fun because I've been stretched and I've really had to learn and develop a lot of new muscles along the way.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I want to go back to dive deeper into some of the stuff you mentioned. One of the things you mentioned is we didn't even know which product, but we knew that we want to lead with generosity. How important was that at that moment, and how does it apply on the daily activities that the company does?
Well, I think it was very important to know what we wanted the company to be about. When we hire new people at the company, the very first day that they work here, usually I sit down and walk through our company mission, vision, values. And when you talk about a company mission statement, it's really a explanation of why the company exists. And I always share this with them. I mean, why does the world need another drinkware company? I mean, there's tons of drinkware companies, right? In many ways, people thought us launching into this industry was insane because there were already so many options and so many well-established companies that were well-run. And my answer to that question is that the world doesn't need another water bottle company, but the world definitely needs more mission-driven companies, more companies that have a holistic view to the way that they are making a positive impact on the world. Not just that they're making life better for the shareholders, not just that they're making life better for the customers, but that they're making the experience and lives of everybody that they touch better. The shareholders, the customers, the local community, the employees, the partners that you work with, both internationally and domestically. So it turns out we touch a lot of people with Simple Water at this point, whether it's the people that buy our products or the people that we work with, people that we employ. And one of the most encouraging and exciting things to me is that I feel like we've been at least somewhat successful in making people's lives better, regardless of how they interact with the company and what their connection with the company is. So for me at the time, it was incredibly important because I really was looking for motivation of what I wanted to be spending my time on. And I found it's difficult. I sit at kind of the Gen X millennial divide age-wise. And I teach these days, so I spend time even around younger generations. And one of the things that I've really seen that is encouraging is that especially younger generations are very mission-driven in the way that they think about business, much more so than previous generations. The problem can be that sometimes there's not the kind of tactical and practical knowledge of how to execute on that. They've got great ideas and great hearts, but they don't have the tactical and practical knowledge of how to do that. And so my experience was I had kind of all the tactical and practical knowledge of how to run a successful e-commerce company and how to lead teams. But I was looking for what is a compelling mission to be a part of. And so it was really important to me to work with people that I felt had a similar vision of the type of culture we were trying to create. As an aside, I would say it this way. The reason why we work hard in our jobs and we want to do well is because we want to create a higher quality of life for us and for our, you know, spouses or children. And one of the reasons why people can get overly focused on money is that it's easy to look at money and say, money's going to help me achieve this higher quality of life. I can exchange that for a higher quality of life. But what's interesting to me, and I've learned this as I've been able to be more financially successful, is that there's really a limitation of what money's able to do in terms of translating into quality of life. But there's other things that very directly translate to quality of life. One of them for me is the environment that you're a part of every day. Correct. If you look at a pie chart of your time, so much of your time in your 30s, 40s, 50s is in work environments. And it's amazing the way that it can suck life out of you or that it can give life. When that is a positive and encouraging and challenging environment to be a part of. And so my main focus was whatever I do next, when we were thinking about starting Simple Modern, whatever I do next, whether it's in the for-profit or nonprofit world, I want to be in environments that add to my quality of life, where I am working with other people who are trying to be about the same things and are trying to accomplish the same mission. And when I realized that that was really what was most important to me, I was able to kind of work backwards from there into, okay, these are people that I would love to start something with. And then eventually we settled on a product. You know, we just so happened to sell water bottles and tumblers is the way I think about it. Really kind of the ethos behind the company and the reason why it exists has nothing to do with hydration. It's more that we were trying to build a particular type of environment and type of company. And it turns out that when you have that mindset, that there, every industry could use more companies like that. It just so happens that we landed on hydration.
I think what you mentioned is so important. And I want the listeners to make sure that they paid attention to this part, is how important the environment you surround yourself is. Because like you said, if you have a positive environment, a growth, you know, mindset, people are with growth mindset around you, all of a sudden you are in that same mindset and you feel left out if you're not.
Yeah.
Versus if you're in the opposite.
Totally true.
Yeah. And I think what I'm hearing, and it's so important, is it's the leader's mission, it's the leader's responsibility to give those people the tools and the environment so they could thrive and actually they could actually be in that positive mode, so to speak. Yeah. So I think it's very important. And I think, but you're raising another point, which is so important, about we need more of mission-driven companies. But what I've seen a lot is where companies, like sometimes we would do a training for leaders and we'll show them our core values, our ethos, and somebody will say, I love them. Could I just use them for my company?
Right.
And I said, you want to put it on your website? It's one thing. You want to do it, you got to make sure that your team and everybody's up for it. And I think we see a lot of people that in the most recent and the culture driven world, where people say, oh, it's a good marketing tool to have something so we might recruit easier. But it has to be true to who they are and actually put it into practice on the daily activities.
Yeah, your values aren't what you say they are. Your values are, and your culture and your mission, it's almost like a 200-day moving average of what people actually experience inside of your organization. And so it's what really happens. It's values are reflected and shown and revealed by who gets promoted, what gets praised, what gets, you know, what gets talked about, what doesn't get talked about. You will see that organizationally. And I'm kind of obsessed with this idea that organizations have both a text and a subtext. The idea is that there's what's said overtly, and then there's what you can observe. And that sometimes those are different. When the text and the subtext are different, what people do is they listen to the subtext. There are a lot of companies that know, okay, it's probably good policy to have a mission and vision and values, right? But like Enron had a value statement. You know, FTX is recently, they had a value statement. It's not about having a value statement. It's about what is the expression that people experience on a day-to-day basis. And that actually shapes the way that they think about the company. And I think, so there's kind of two parts in helping aspiring entrepreneurs apply this. One is helping them to understand how to model and create the kind of culture that they want. It's one thing to say, I would love for the culture to look like this. It's a different thing to understand. How do you actually cultivate that and model that to a team? And then the second part of is the part I already mentioned, which is helping people to understand that the first and most important thing is that you do have to be competent at what you do, and that you have to be able to execute on the business fundamentals, or that overwhelms whatever great-hearted thoughts you have about your culture. Like, it doesn't matter how good your culture is if you're laying people off left and right, because sure, company can't make payroll. And so one of the ways that I'll communicate sometimes is that earn the right to be idealistic. Like, I really encourage people to think about their businesses in a higher way and with more of an idealistic lens, but also to be practical and realistic that you have to execute in By executing and by delivering value to customers, you earn the right to be able to define your culture. You earn the right to be able to do things by a different set of rules. And so anyway, it's kind of that dualistic approach that I think the most successful businesses that I've been in contact with are able to achieve.
Let's speak about culture. And I think there's a lot of misconception out there. And the reason why is when you think about name a company with great culture, they'll mention Google or one of those tech companies that have ping pong tables and a babysitting service. And we believe, and I based on what you have written, culture is so much more important and so much more serious than the fun part of what the company could provide in perks. What would you say, what is your definition of a healthy, in a culture of excellence?
I think the main thing is that, so I'll say a couple of things that I don't know if they're controversial, but you don't hear people say them. Here's the first one. There is this idea that the most important thing for successful teams is diversity. And so let me poke at that idea for a minute. Diversity is good when we're talking about having different perspectives on how to solve problems, different skill sets, and different insights as a result of experiencing the world differently. Like some people are abstract and some are concrete. And for sure, I think with our teams, we need to strive for that. You can even say, hey, when people have different backgrounds or are different genders or are different races, like they can bring different perspectives and that is helpful. Here is where different perspectives is unhelpful. It's incredibly unhelpful when you have different perspectives on values. That strong teams and strong cultures are always built around shared values and shared cause. There's just no other way to do it. And I think one of the things our culture has missed on is it's gotten so big on diversity that it's missed that like strong organizations are always rallied around a central set of beliefs that are held by everyone. That's what brings people together and makes them so strong. Because if you don't have that, then like, what are you even doing? And a lot of the kind of corporations and organizations we see in our culture today, it's like really if the only central kind of value is making money that everybody's rallied behind. And so, you mentioned Google and some of these companies. And listen, I think they probably have great culture when things are going well. Right now, Silicon Valley, a bunch of companies are going through layoffs. And a bunch of those companies that got great marks for culture, probably you're not going to get great marks for culture over, like Facebook's not going to get great marks for culture over the next year because there's adversity. Great culture transcends circumstance. It's not like I would rate it 9 out of 10 today, but if we have adverse conditions 6 months from now, I'd rate it a 4 out of 10. Great culture is actually about finding a group of people where you're bonded with them in a common mission with common values. And that's actually what makes it great is that you feel like you're a part of something bigger than yourself and that you're working with other people that you mentioned this earlier that challenge you and that help call you up to being the best version. So that's the idea that I would start with is if you as the leader cannot define, here is what we are about. These are the hills we die on as a company, you know, and if you can't do that, then how can you attract and retain passionate people? Because that's really the advantage of mission-driven founders is that you're competing with a bunch of companies that are like, yeah, we'll offer you a job, we'll treat you decent, and you'll earn good pay. And it's like, that's okay if that's the best you can get. But all of us want to be a part of something bigger than that. I mean, we invest so much of our lives in working and that I hope, I'm sure you hope, we all hope that work actually makes some kind of a dent in a positive way in the world and in the universe. And that we want to be a part of something. We want to have a larger narrative that our life ties into. We're in a very secularistic culture where a lot of that's been stripped out, where it's like, hey, this is just a bunch of kind of randomness. But at a heart level, what we really want to know is we want to know that our life matters, that it's part of something bigger. And we want to understand the larger story that it ties into. When you're able to create teams and organizations where there's shared values and there's shared mission, that taps into something that we all want to be a part of. And so I think that that's where it starts. And you cannot impart what you don't possess. So you can't create a culture that's about these things unless you have personal convictions around things. I mean, that's probably the other thing I'd say is that great founders, great cultures, they start with deep convictions, right?
Yes.
Like, you know, Amazon had deep convictions about the way that they want, what the way the world should work and the way they wanted to serve the customer and the type of company they wanted to build. And Amazon's culture is not for everyone, right? But they were able to create a really strong culture because the entire thing was built around this shared
customer centric.
That's right. Customer centric and hardworking and frugal. Like there were several characteristics that it's not for everybody, but for the people it's for, you know, there's 100% buy-in, right?
Yeah. And I think you're mentioning something that we live in a world that sometimes the, you know, society pushes on something to organizations, to the businesses. And now the leaders are just there to check a box. You mentioned about the right. diversity. If the only reason why you're actually embracing diversity is just to be able to check off a box, then, and that's where it starts, that's where it ends, then ultimately you're basically, you're hurting your culture and you're actually hurting those people that you're actually hiring long term.
Yeah. Yeah. The challenge for a leader is that finding more people that share the absolute core of what you're about, that think about it in new and unique ways that you didn't. Like that is really helpful. And I get challenged all the time by people who, you know, when I share that our desire is to build a generous company, that are able to bring new perspectives on that. And I love it. I welcome it. I need it. But that's the kind of diversity you want. I don't need the kind of diversity where I have people on my team that are like, why are we giving away some of our profits every year? We could grow much bigger as a business if we didn't do this. Like, I don't need to be litigating those kind of things internally or dealing with, you know, dissent if we do smaller amounts in bonuses so we can still do our company giving this year. Like, I need an organization full of people that are really bought into that idea. And what I have found is that it is self-fulfilling. It's a positive feedback loop that the more that you recruit around a core mission and values, the easier it becomes to recruit because it becomes really clear when somebody's probably a fit or not. And it kind of self-perpetuates. There was a period where, you know, I was there at the very beginning of the company. Now we're probably at 70 employees, but there was a period at the beginning where I really had to set the culture in so many different ways. But if you think about the company today, I only make up a small percentage of the interactions that people have with Simple Modern. The vast majority of Simple Modern's culture and the way that people experience it has nothing to do with me. It's employees and how they experience it, you know, teammates and how they experience each other or how customers experience, you know, a customer support specialist or, you know, how one of our retail partners experiences our sales team or whatever. And so at this point, we've gotten to the organization and its culture is really more dictated by others than me. I can still say, this is what we want to be about and I want to lead in that. But what's great is because we've built a critical mass of people that are really bought into what we're trying to build, it's not up to me to kind of like police this or to make sure it's this way. The natural inertia of the organization is to attract and hire and incorporate more and more people that have this common vision of like, hey, what if we built a different type of company?
This episode of the Let's Talk Business podcast is brought to you by the PTEX Group. Whether you're a small business or a large enterprise, whichever industry you work in, there's always a next step for your brand to take. Increasing your sales, expanding markets, getting into big box stores, growing from local brand to household name. Whatever that next iteration of your business is, at PTEX Group, we're here to give you the look, the feel, the voice, and the results that make your brand move forward. Our team of experienced creatives has successfully helped hundreds of brands across nearly every industry, from e-commerce to healthcare to nonprofit and everything in between, take the next step in their brand journey. If you're a driven brand looking to take your business to the next level, give us a call at 888-977-7839. That's 888-977-7839. Or schedule a call at ptexgroup.com/letstalk and let's create your next. Now, let's get back to the show.
I think what you're just mentioning is also one of the main benefits of having set values for a company, having core focus and core values, because at one point you're not interacting with the client with every team member and every customer. And like I use the standard when I speak to my team members is I want to build a company that if my parents want something and they used to call me, will I be comfortable if I give them, you know, call John or call, you know, Abe, they'll take care of you.
Because
if you have core values, you know how you operate and what drives you and how you work ethics and so on and so forth, and that's passed on throughout the culture, you need to have that seeming, the same way, regardless of who was actually picking up that phone.
Absolutely. And some of the stories that have made me the most, I'd say, proud of the organization have been examples where people have experienced excellence or generosity or humility, some of these values that we really put forth through our teammates. And I haven't been involved at all. Just stories that get back to me.
Beautiful.
You know, and it really, it makes you proud. It makes you proud of being able to help create something that is having the kind of impact that you want it to have.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you another critical piece to a great culture, obviously, is you wrote about it. You call it transparency. In other organizations, it's the challenge of communication. As the company is growing and scaling, what would you say is ways a company could, you know, stay transparent so people that are joining the company know what's happening, they know how they actually contribute to the company's success, and in general communication, making sure that everybody's up to date with what's happening?
Yeah, so I think there's several things worth saying here. The genesis of me realizing how critical transparency was, I've always felt like it's an important characteristic just in your personal characters that you're transparent. About 2 years ago during COVID, we were working remote and I did a kind of barnstorming tour where I did a one-on-one via Zoom with every single person on our team. There's probably 40 of these. And I had an entire questionnaire that I went through, asking them about the company, asking them about leadership, how they experienced different things. And one of the questions was, what is your favorite thing about the leadership or about the culture of the leadership? It was something like to that extent. There were no answers. It wasn't multiple choice. It was just totally like people were able to give whatever popped
open-ended box.
That's right. And I think 70% of people voluntarily chose the word transparency. And it was kind of a wow moment for me of that so many people would independently land on the exact same thing. And I realized, wow, this is a huge deal to the team, but also it seems like we've really been able to achieve that kind of a culture. A few ways that we attempt to cultivate transparency. One is pretty straightforward. We have times in our week that are really devoted to developing our team and to sharing with them what's going on. We recently changed up our schedule, but for a long time it was Monday morning meetings where we would give kind of a business update from one of our groups. And then Tuesday morning where it was like an hour, it's just developmental. So either there would be an interview with one of the leaders at the company sharing their backstory, their life, you know, personal story, or it would be me talking about one of the company's core values or giving a strategy update on something or talking about, you know, we brought in a leadership development coach for several sessions over the last year. So those things I think have really helped in that employees know what's going on and they know what the company wants to be about. But there's another thing that we've done that's one of the more simple things we've done, but it's been pretty revolutionary. We pay for lunches every day that people are in office. And if you come to the Simple Modern office during lunchtime, what you'll see, we're in office 3 days a week, and then we have kind of a hybrid model on Mondays and Fridays. But if you came to our office during lunch, what you would see is literally the entire team gathered around tables having lunch together. And that happens every single day that everybody's in the office. And what it's done is created so much more relational connectedness, and people really know each other, not just like their names and what they do, but they know what they're about. They know what's going on in their life. People don't leave campus for lunch because we bring in great lunch and it's free. And it's one of their favorite parts of the entire week is they get time to actually connect with their coworkers. And what it creates is this culture of people knowing each other and people and transparency. I think another piece here is a willingness to say difficult things and to treat people like adults. That often we, in our culture, that just doesn't happen. You know, whether it's the way that politicians will say things to us that we just know aren't really accurate, or people trying to kind of, you know, we've all been in situations where somebody was trying to kind of protect us from bad news and that made it worse. That when we treat people like adults and we treat them with dignity, and like when things are hard, we say that they're hard. And that doesn't mean we have to rant and rave. It's just being honest. Like, this is difficult and here's where we made mistakes and here's how we can get better. But it's also the opposite of that, that we have a culture where we try and be really deliberate about encouragement and affirmation and people transparently sharing with others the positive ways that their life is impacted by them. So, you know, transparency is really the exercise of allowing other people to see within what you're thinking. And that just takes effort, right? But when you build a culture where both relationally, organizationally, strategically, there is this kind of open door policy where you want people to understand what's going on, they love it. Because what, and here's one of the reasons, Minnie, why I think it makes a big difference. We are constantly trying to evaluate something as humans, and that is why other people do what they do. This is the fundamental way that we decide whether or not we like people, whether or not we trust people, whether or not we want to work with other people, we believe in them. It goes back to us observing their actions and also trying to work backwards into why they do what they do. What makes them tick? And the reason why transparency is so powerful is that when it's authentic, transparency allows us to understand motive and drive and why people do what they do. And when we see what's going on inside of other people and we like it, it bonds us to them at a totally different level. And it creates trust. It creates affinity. And that's what really strong teams have. You know, McKinsey has done studies, really the highest performing teams, the number one characteristic, it's trust.
Sure.
They trust each other. And the way that you build trust is through transparency. You and I would never be able to trust someone that we had no idea what their motives were or what they were doing. You know, like it's impossible to foster trust. But when you feel like you can really see the reality of who somebody else is or what an organization is, the warts and all, and say, oh, okay, I really do trust that thing, the level of buy-in, it grows by an order of magnitude. So that's some of the way that I think about it. But it really starts at the top. I'll give another really practical. I mean, this is probably the most practical thing I can say, because a lot of this stuff is kind of 10,000 foot view. Transparent leaders take responsibility for their mistakes. They concretely call them out in front of other people voluntarily, not when they have to, but they voluntarily do it. They voluntarily show the people that they lead that they are not perfect and that there are ways they could have done things better. And that they use that as an opportunity through their own humility, through their own highlighting their own mistakes, to show people the way that they are growing, the way that they would approach things differently. You're able to deconstruct thought processes and both mentor and develop your people, and at the same time show them a form of leadership that's compelling. We don't want perfect leaders. We want real leaders. We want leaders that represent what we want to be about and that we feel confident giving our time and our effort towards supporting. Because leadership is fundamentally just about organizing people towards causes. So when we see leaders that are like that, leaders that are just as quick to say, man, I messed up and here's the reason why, and here's some things that I think the team can learn from it, as they are to try and take credit. Like when we have leadership like that, it's easy to get excited about working with them. It's easy to get excited about tackling big projects together. And that's what I think people want more of in our culture.
Sure. And you know, sometimes leaders think that's a weakness, a sign of weakness. But at the end of the day, it's a sign of strength. Because you just score points, your team sees that you're there when you need to give praises, you're there when you need to take responsibility, and it just builds that transparency, as you said, and I think which leads to trust.
Yeah, so you nailed it. I think insecurity and transparency are antonyms, right? That they are opposites. The more insecure you are, or they're inversely correlated, we could say, the more insecure you are, the more difficult it is to be transparent. But ironically, the more transparent you are, the less you have to feel insecure about, because you know that people already know. Like there's a strategy that I have. I have weaknesses just like anybody, right? But one of my strategies that's really helpful in dealing with my weaknesses is I self-sabotage. So usually the way it works is we have weaknesses and it's like, okay, I'm going to try and hide these. I don't want other people to see these because it makes me feel, you know, because it's not my best stuff. And so I'm going to try and kind of hide it and try and kind of like not show other people these aspects, you know, that I struggle with. But what if you go the other way? What if instead you wear it on your sleeve and are like, hey, you know what, guys, sometimes I can be prideful. Sometimes I can try and, you know, take credit for things I shouldn't. And sometimes, you know, what I can have, like I can be quick to take over a project. Let's just say that's kind of your thing. And you know what? These are things I struggle with. And so I want you to be aware of that because that's not who I want to be. Yeah. And let me know when you see that. You know, it won't be surprising. I can do this. This is totally, you know, these are things that I've done in the past, but it's not who I want to be. And I want you to feel free to just mention it to me when you see those things. Well, all of a sudden, number one, like if you're somebody on the other side of hearing that, you're like, wow, that person really wants to grow and is really transparent. And I can get behind that, right? And number two, like the leader, it's like you have so much less surface area to be insecure about. You've already told everybody all of the secrets that you'd want to hide, right? Mm-hmm. It's like they're already aware. And so anyway, I think that there's another piece here, which is strong leaders are quick to take the blame and slow to take the credit. You know, I mean, we just know this, but I do think there is something related to transparency there as well, that they're quick to be transparent about the ways that they could have been better. And that is always appreciated by other people.
Yes. I'll just add 2 points on that. One is that sometimes leaders will be transparent about their weaknesses and they'll actually get feedback from team members. By the way, for the last few months, I've seen a huge improvement, you know, and all of a sudden then you can start building your insecurity on that as well, because you're getting real-time feedback on how your team feels about it.
Yeah.
That's one important part. And the other part is that, you know, as a leader, you want to be, you know, if you build a great organization, everything your team does automatically, you should be satisfying enough that that's where the credit comes from. You don't have to spell out the credit that you're getting if your team does something.
Yeah, you nailed it. Feedback loops are critical in business. Business is really kind of in some ways about building feedback loops and then taking that information and making things better. And as individuals, the way that we grow is through feedback loops. We grow through other people saying, hey, I watched you do X and this is a couple of things I thought you could have done better, or ways that, you know, I experienced you. Sometimes it's like, yeah, I'm aware of that. You know, sometimes it's like, wow, I didn't even realize that. That's helpful. Thank you for pointing that out. That what we need is mirrors that show us what other people see so that we see ourselves more clearly. And when we see ourselves more clearly, it's easy to understand how we need to grow and how we can grow, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is, it's dangerous to be a mirror for somebody else. In the world that we live in, a lot of times when people see their reflection and it's not something they want to see, they get angry at the mirror. It's like, how dare you, right? And especially as leaders, it's easy to have that kind of a mindset where you say, oh, I'm open to feedback. I want this to be a transparent culture. I want people to be able to share what they see. And you can say that right up until the point that somebody does offer something that you don't like, you know? And so one of the really tangible things you can do as a leader is, I'll just say it this way. A life-changing moment for me was when I said, from this point on, I'm going to assume when somebody brings constructive feedback, I'm going to assume they are right. You know, in our legal system, there's this presumption of innocence until proven guilty. And this is how we treat ourselves when other people bring, you know, constructive feedback or try to act as a mirror to us. It's like, well, you're going to have to prove it to me, right? What if instead we took the opposite? What if the view was, you know what? I am a very imperfect person and I am definitely in need of growth as a leader, and our organization is definitely in need of growth. And so when anybody brings something critical, I am going to assume that they are right instead of assuming that they're wrong. How would that impact my stance, the way that I receive that? Because what people will do is they'll hear you say, I want a transparent culture. I want people to be able to tell me anything. And after a while, they're like, okay, I'm going to test. I'm going to see if you're for real. And they'll bring you something. And what you do in that moment is critical. If you push back or minimize, mentally, they're going to be like, I knew it. You're just like everybody else. If instead you take a stance of, hey, thank you, that's really helpful. I think that's really valid. And that's an area I need to grow in. And I really appreciate it. Then it's like, oh, okay. And you know what's crazy is when you're a person that can receive feedback, other people will naturally start to receive feedback more readily that because you create that culture. Anyway.
Oh, it's beautiful. And I think if you could have a transparent and in a culture that communication, you know, is flowing properly, there's so much the business could do as a whole versus being the bottleneck and being stuck on all the different, you know, internally by having a dysfunctional team working together. I want to go back to, obviously, you tapped into a market which obviously was saturated. You're not the first company doing what you're doing. Give us a little bit of the mindset, like going into it as you started building out those product lines and thinking, okay, this is where we're putting our mission to test. And like, what was the mindset? And I think for our listeners, just to get our feel, because people sometimes know they want to go into a market and they're looking at the market as a whole and seeing, okay, do we have place? Could we get market share? What could you share from that thinking process, so to speak?
Yeah, I've talked a lot about this. I think every startup starts with a theory. And the theory has something to do with, I think that we could achieve product market fit in this way, that there is this white space that we could come and achieve product market fit in. And the process of determining if you have product market fit and kind of making pivots to get to product market fit, that is kind of the early stages of entrepreneurship. And our theory was that hydration was really big, that it was going to become more of an accessory type item than just a functional item. So a lot more like shoes than just a water bottle that, yes, use it to drink water, but it also has this fashion piece. And like, there's also kind of a stylistic piece of it. And that ended up being, I think, true, that it became more of an accessory that had both a functional and a kind of a stylistic role. We also had a theory that there was white space in selling on the Amazon marketplace, that the strongest competitors in our space had really focused on physical retail distribution and had not prioritized digital distribution as much. One of the easiest ways that I can communicate this is when you look at an industry, it's easy to look at the best players and say, these are all the reasons they're so good and it's so difficult to compete with them. But you can take that and invert that and say, all the things that make them great, there are trade-offs that they intentionally choose to not do as a result, right? Like Louis Vuitton is never making a $50 bag, right? They're just never going to do it. And so there are things that Louis Vuitton does great, but by definition, the things that they do great, there are other things that they will never do great because it's antithetical, okay? So when you look at a market, if you can look at the strong competitors and say, where is the white space in the things they're intentionally trying to not do great? Then you can actually sometimes find what the path is for an additional startup. And the reality is, you know, 99% of startups that are successful are in markets that already exist, that have proven demand, and there's just a new distribution channel or a new combination of services or a new pricing model or some new derivative that meets customers' needs. When I talk to entrepreneurship students, often the misconception is I need to come up with something that no one's ever seen before because that's how I'm going to be successful. So the first thing is you have a theory about what is the white space, and there's this process of just determining where the white space is and kind of sliding into that. While that's going on, there's a second piece that I think is critical, which is that you have to have a theory about how you hold on to it. You have to have a theory about how you moat it. And a lot of companies focus on the first, but they don't focus on the second. And that's the problem. That's why they get some traction and maybe there's some growth. And then, oh man, Facebook's pixel, you know, gets broken by iOS 14. And all of a sudden the business model's blown up, is that there's not this understanding of how to actually create a longer term competitive advantage in a moat. So I encourage people to do both at the inception stage, that you not only have the theory about how to achieve product market fit, but the theory about how to expand that into a sustainable competitive advantage. Because the reality is if you only have one, you've got nothing, right? Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to say, well, we're just going to figure out sustainable competitive advantage once we get there. So for us, we realized that licensing would play a role in that. We realized that brand would be an important part of that. Obviously, we realized that IP and product design would have to be a part of that. That there were, that we realized that team and culture could be a part of that. I mean, one thing that people don't think about enough is one way that you can create a long-term sustainable competitive advantage is you can be, you can build a better team than anybody in your industry. Sure. The only person that controls that is you, right? And so anyway, we realized, okay, these are the things that we can control and that we want to really focus on even in the early days. And so as a result, not only were we able to find product market fit, but once we had it, I mean, we're in a fairly, I think what makes our story unique, the more I've talked to people, is there are a lot of people that got traction on the Amazon marketplace and even grew that into, you know, a significant amount of sales. Very, very few of those companies have ever taken that and turned that into kind of a national or international brand. And there's a lot of headwinds and a lot of things that work against being able to make that jump, but we've been able to do it. I think a lot of the reason why we've been able to do it is because we were focused on doing that from the very beginning of how do we parlay this initial product market fit into, you know, a longer term sustainable brand.
So I actually wanted to ask you that question because there's two places where I saw a long-term vision. One is the split between e-commerce and physical stores. And the second is mentioned before, which is the part that you decided to actually open up your own manufacturing facilities locally. So I want to frame the question in a way that like a lot of startups, and especially the early years, there's so much focus on the now that they don't have the bandwidth to focus on the long-term vision. For as a founder and a CEO, like how do you balancing making sure that you're focusing on the now, especially if you're selling on Amazon, which is changing every day, is so much on the now. Mm-hmm. Like how do you balancing to make sure that you have a strong enough now to be able to put in the effort for the long-term sustainability?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And there are times in every business where it is triage. It's like, okay, we got to make payroll next month. So I've experienced those periods. I think that it goes back to vision, that you want to have an idea of what you're trying to build towards. If all you're trying to do is just survive month to month, then it's like, it's just, first of all, it's going to be a miserable experience. And second of all, you're not going to be able to build anything of significant value. So you have to have some kind of a view of like, what is the future that I'm trying to live in look like? And why would it be worth living in? And why would our company be strong in that? And then you can work all the way backwards into, because of that, if I do this advertising campaign with excellence, that drives additional gross profit, which allows me to do, you know, to invest in this new product line, which allows this. And I can see how that builds towards my long-term vision. So when you think about the term working backwards, this is the way that I would apply it within a business is, you do have to be focused on what is in front of you and doing that with excellence, but forcing yourself to mentally explain, if I am successful, if I do this with excellence, how does this help build towards the future that I'm trying to build, the company that we're trying to build, the product we're trying to build? You should always be asking yourself that question. So even now, it's like I have clarity on that with our business. It's that when we are more profitable, I'm able to invest more in domestic manufacturing. I'm able to do more product launches and I'm able to give more to our nonprofit partners. All those things are true. And so, yes, I will go and negotiate hard with our wholesale partners for that extra dime. You know, there's a famous story about how Walmart trains buyers, that they train buyers. Buyers are doing all of these financial negotiations that are very tactical, right? And it can get easy to just kind of get tied up in that. But one of the ways that they help the buyer is they say, listen, you need to envision the millions of customers that you're serving in the room with you. Amazon has a similar thing where they're like, you know, they have an empty seat that represents the voice of the customer at every, like, you know, executive meeting or something. But that when you negotiate that extra nickel, what you did is it's like putting a nickel in millions of people's bank account for them. You know, and that's why you're motivated to negotiate hard on this tactical negotiation of how much a Kraft, you know, slices of cheese package is going to cost at wholesale. So in the same way, I think when we're able to do that with our businesses, the reason why I want to make the best PR hire possible is because if I make the best PR hire possible, that will lead to these opportunities, which unlocks the ability to position the brand this way, which, you know, whatever, that you're able to kind of communicate that. This is also a fundamental piece of leading your team well. If your team feels like you're constantly just giving them to-do lists, like that is not compelling. There's a quote that I love that it's like, if you want your people to build ships, you don't talk to them about gathering lumber, you know, and hammer and nails, but you talk to them about the sea and how great the sea is. And then they naturally want to go and grab the lumber and the hammer and nails, right? And that's the idea is like with our people, the more that we can say, here is the vision of the company we're trying to create, the impact that we want to be capable of having, the products we want to be capable of producing, for any of that to happen, we got to kill it this Q4. We've got to make Black Friday our best Black Friday ever. And here's all the things we're going to do to make that happen. But make no mistake, just killing it on Black Friday in itself, that's not the goal. The goal is to build this future that we all want to be a part of, right?
Beautiful, beautiful. Let me ask you one more question, which is obviously there's a quote from Dave Ramsey that the organization will never outgrow its leader. You as a leader, starting from being a startup leader, and now you have over 70 employees and 9 figures in revenue. What are you doing to keeping fresh and keeping constantly that momentum of growth?
Well, I think one thing is you try and hire people that do challenge you and that you can learn from, you know, like that if you don't have the ability to grow from your internal people, then that's very constraining. Like everybody's dependent on me. I'm kind of the cap on the organization, but I've been fortunate enough to build a leadership team where many of them are more gifted than I am in a lot of areas. And that it doesn't have to be just about where is my cap on everything. Instead, it's like, you know, we're only as good analytically as our best person in the company is analytically, but they might be much better than me. So this is one of the reasons why going and finding other great people that are even better than you in areas is really helpful. I'm a part of a lot of groups of CEOs, like text chats and things like that, that have been really helpful to hear other people's perspective, to give encouragement. I read as much as I can with Audible. I listen, I guess, more than I read, but I've probably done something in the ballpark of 50,000 pages of biographies over the last 2 years.
Oh, nice.
And I found it to be incredibly helpful to listen to the lives of other people and to learn from what they learned. I mean, when you read a biography, you really get an opportunity to get a lifetime's worth of learning from someone in just a few hours. And that's been really helpful. But in general, I think it's just having a lifetime learner mentality. That I hope I understand more tomorrow than I do today. I hope that I'm continuing to grow. And I love it. I love it when I run into something in the business where I'm like, I don't know how to do this, because it's an opportunity for growth. And so continuing to try and push myself and grow myself. You can't impart what you don't possess, right? I said that earlier, and it's the same principle, like that, you know, you can't expect your people to grow faster or more than you are growing as a leader. You can't expect them to push themselves more than you're willing to push yourself.
This has been great. Let's close with the 4 rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Okay. Sounds great.
Number one, a book that changed your life.
A book that changed my life. Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis.
Number 2, a piece of advice you got that you'll never forget.
It was about humility. I was on a summer assignment somewhere with the nonprofit I worked for, and I was being mentored by another staff that summer, and he talked to me about humility and about meekness. And I really can be, I can be just as prideful as anybody. And I think that was kind of near the beginning of really having my life transformed in the area of humility.
Beautiful. Number 3, anything you could wish you could go back and do differently?
I've thought about this, and I don't know if the answer is yes. There are lots of things that I'm not proud of that I would go back and, you know, it's like in a vacuum, would I go back and do that differently? But what's interesting is I feel like where my life is today, I'm very proud of. And so if I go back and change things, I'm not necessarily where I am today, you know? And so, yeah. So instead of feeling like regret or like I wish I could change things, I think it's more that I've taken away ways that I want to be different and ways I approach things different because of the experiences I've had.
Beautiful. And last and final question, what's still on your bucket list to achieve?
My bucket list to achieve, I think it would probably be in the area of giving, that my wife and I really are motivated by this idea of giving sacrificially. And as the company's been more financially successful, I think one of the big question marks that I've had of myself internally is, am I going to be able to have the kind of character to continue to prioritize generosity as there's more and more ability and incentive to act selfishly? And so I've been encouraged by the way that I feel like my heart and my mindset's been trending, but I think that's going to be, that's the ongoing challenge for me. Now, I mean, I think about it as I'm kind of probably halfway through my life. Am I going to be able to finish well with the convictions and the direction that I want to be headed in? Because a lot of people don't finish the second half of their life well, I've observed. And so I'd like to believe, I hope that I'm not that type of person. But so for me, the bucket list is mostly about actually fulfilling the things that I want to be about and being able to walk that out.
Amazing. Mike, thank you so much for joining us. I know your time is valuable. That is why, in the name of our listeners, we'll forever be grateful for sharing some of your time with us today. It's been a blast.
It's been great being with you. Thanks, Nini.
Thank you. That is my conversation with Mike Beckham. My takeaway from this one, number one, you need to be competent at what you do and execute the business fundamentals regardless of how you define your culture. If you are laying people off left and right, it doesn't matter whether you try to embody a culture that claims to value its employees. Only be executing and delivering value to customers do you earn the right to run your business according to the values you care about. Number two, while diversity is important, don't forget that some types of diversity are helpful and some are counterproductive. When you hire people who have different perspectives, different skill sets, and different experiences, you help your company tremendously, but everyone needs to be aligned on the same central values that define the company culture. Diversity in values will tear your company apart. Number three, transparency is the exercise of allowing other people inside to see what you're thinking. A culture of transparency can be cultivated by treating employees with dignity, by telling them difficult truths, as well as about positive development. It also happens through regular meetings and even joint lunches where everybody in the company can talk honestly and openly about what they do, what they want to do, and how best to get there. And number four, entrepreneurs often believe that success means coming up with something that no one has ever thought before. In reality, 99% of successful startups are in existing markets with proven demand. In those markets, you just need to find a new distribution channel or pricing model that will meet the customer needs.
Thanks for listening to this week's interview. Before we conclude the show, we're going to hear from you, our amazing listeners. This segment, Inside the Inbox, is where we discuss a specific business, leadership, or growth-related question that came from one of our listeners. Let's see what's inside the inbox today.
Our question this week comes from Jake, and he asks, I run a small online business and have a limited budget for marketing. How can I figure out the best way to use the money to maximize its effect on growing my business? Now, Jake, this is a very vague question because I don't know enough about your business, nor do I know what your cost for acquisition is, meaning to say, how much does it really cost you in marketing dollars to actually acquire a new customer? But I will tell you with a blanket statement, when somebody has a limited budget for marketing, you usually do not want to spend it on new endeavors, in new initiatives. Rather, look back at your last 10, 20, 30, 50 clients you received and figure out what is the common denominator. How did they get to you? How did they find out about you? And ultimately, how did they decide to actually become your clients? Most of the time, that will be the cheapest way of continuing what's already working and going after that market again with limited amount of budgets rather than trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work and ultimately spending a lot of money on testing. So again, since I don't know more about your business, this will be just a blanket statement for every business owner. As you're looking at what's working or what's not working and how you should spend your marketing dollars, always look at your past customers and see through which channels did they arrive to you, and ultimately double down on that. That will usually be your cheapest way of continuing your marketing initiatives. If you have a question for the show, please email it to podcast@ptechsgroup.com.
That's a wrap on another episode of Let's Talk Business, the podcast for no-nonsense advice to help you grow and lead. Subscribe to the Let's Talk Business show on your favorite podcast app or on our website at www.ptexgroup.com/podcast. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. Do you know other entrepreneurs who want to turn their ambition into action and passion into profits? Sharing is caring. Tell them about the show. The Let's Talk Business show is a production of PTEX Group. For more information, visit www.ptexgroup.com.